Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you Saturday afternoons at 1 here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmj580.com. Want to give you a heads up, no program next week. Bulldog Baseball will start at 1 from San Jose State with a doubleheader, the spring football scrimmage mixed in. So a big day of Fresno State sports next Saturday, but Hometown Heroes will be preempted. We'll be back with you the following week, visiting once again with World War II veterans from here in our valley. There are heroes in every hometown. And remember, you can always let me know about the hero in your hometown by emailing me, paul@kmj580.com. Before we get started with our guest today, Pete Giannopoulos, I want to remind you about the Heroes of the Valley celebration at the Downtown Museum, the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno. That is coming up on Sunday, May the 24th at 2 o'clock. It's a free event. If you do want to spend a little money, you can get into the theater presentation, buy a tri-tip lunch. But for more information on that, I want you to go to heroesofthevalley.com or call 323-9226 in the 559 area code. Okay, let's get to today's guest, Pete Giannopoulos, known to so many as the mayor of Taft, a post that he held for two terms, and I think everyone still refers to him as the mayor down there. He writes a column in the Midway Driller, that's the newspaper in Taft, and sends out a newsletter to almost 500 of his closest friends as well. So he's very well known in that part of our valley, and we're going to hear maybe some stories you haven't heard from Pete today. Pete, what kind of stories are you going to tell us today?
Well, Paul, thank you very much for that introduction. I'm going to summarize what we'll be talking about. I was in the Army for 3 years. I got out because the war was over. I was in Regimental Headquarters Company of the 163rd Infantry Regiment, one of three regiments in the 41st Infantry Division. I participated in amphibious landings in New Guinea, at Idapi, Tome, Wakhti Island, and Biak Island, and made landings in the Philippines at Zamboanga and Jolo, and after the war became a part of the Army of Occupation of Japan in Hiro, Kure, and the Hiroshima areas. All that in a nutshell is my 30 months overseas.
Well, and I've gotten a little sneak peek from you about some of the experiences that you had, and I want to hear all about that from you and hear why you guys were known as the Jungleers there in the 41st Infantry Division. But let's start with how you ended up in the service, first of all. I always enjoy going over that with the different veterans that we have on the program because everyone has a different story. How did you end up serving Uncle Sam in the Army?
Well, December 7th, 1941, we know what happened in Honolulu, and I was a senior in high school, and our superintendent brought everybody into the auditorium, and they had a big old one of those tall radios on the stage with a microphone in front, and we listened to President Roosevelt asking Congress to declare war against Japan.
And what high school was that?
Taft Union High School.
Surprise, surprise. So you and all the other...
I was born in Taft, by the way.
Uh-huh. So you and all the rest of the Taft Wildcats are gathered in the gymnasium?
In the auditorium.
In the auditorium. And so that's where you heard President Roosevelt give his famous speech about yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy?
That's exactly the speech. Anyway, being 17, I figured, well, they're drafting people at 21. I still had quite a bit of time. Well, that didn't last too long. They lowered the draft age to 18.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of us decided we would join the Reserve Corps, Army Reserve Corps, because we were told that we could continue our education. So I joined up with the 9 others, was sworn in. That was about mid-December of 42, and continued my education. But I started the second semester, and we were all called in.
Mm-hmm.
So in March 6th, I think it was, we had 5 of us from the high school had to report to the Presidio in Monterey to be inducted in the Army. So we were given tickets on a bus to take us to Bakersfield to the train depot. And that was my first experience leaving home, and it was pretty sad.
I can imagine. Here, you had no idea, I imagine, what you were going to face and what to expect at that point.
Not at all. So I was one of the 18-year-olds called in, and it was a very tearful departure from home to the bus station. We ended up at the depot in Bakersfield, boarded the train, and what made it worse, it was all other recruits boarding the train just like us. So every stop along the way to San Francisco and then to the Presidio of Monterey, we would see these people saying goodbye to their sons as they boarded that train.
Mm.
It wasn't a very pleasant trip. Anyway, we ended up at Camp Roberts eventually after going through about 4 days of preliminary stuff at the Presidio in Monterey. And at Camp Roberts, which was a sprawling Army depot, we were assigned to companies, and I ended up in a heavy weapons company. And we went through 13 weeks of basic training to learn what we were supposed to do as in the Army, primarily for heavy weapons, heavy machine gun, mortars, and the like. After our 13 weeks basic training, we boarded the train again and went north to Camp Stoneman, which is just outside of Pittsburgh, California.
Mm-hmm. And here you are, still an 18-year-old kid from Taft, so
that's right.
Kind of the whole world is opening up to you here, huh?
What an experience. Anyway, we didn't stay too long at Camp Stoneman. We boarded a boat that took us down the river, Sacramento River, to Oakland. And there we boarded a troop ship called the Mormaxi. And when we had loaded 1,500 of us, we sailed out of the bay and into the Pacific Ocean on our way to Australia.
Now, what is going through your mind at the time? Do you have any idea what kind of things you were going to face? What did you expect was going to happen?
I really had no idea what was going to happen to us. All I knew, we were aboard ship. It was a terrible experience. For instance, they had no freshwater showers. That was the first thing we found out. I took one shower in salt water with soap, and you can't wash soap off with salt water.
Just all slimy, huh?
We didn't take any more showers. for 18 days, if you can imagine.
Well, I guess clothespins might have come in handy at that point.
And the way, you know, those troop ships were built, they had cots down in the hold, and they were about 6 or 7 deep. And talk about smell. Of course, pretty bad with our bodies not having been cleaned. And in fact, we didn't even change clothes.
Yeah, that's quite the mental picture. And I'm glad that those smell memories don't pass through the radio, because I might be in pain right now.
Well,
so you're at sea, heading all the way to Australia.
Zigzagging every few minutes, they would zigzag. We were the only ship. There were no other ships protecting us at all, and that was the way to avoid torpedoes from submarines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at one point, somewhere along the way, we got into a heck of a rainstorm. Guess what we did? We all took off our clothes, took a bar of soap and towel, and we went to the deck.
There's your freshwater shower, huh?
That was it. shower all the way to Australia.
Thanks to Mother Nature. Hey, Pete, let me cut you off right there. We need to catch our first commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to hear what Pete Giannopoulos experienced once he did get overseas with the 41st Infantry Division, the 163rd Infantry Regiment, and some of the really incredible experiences he had. You've seen the TV shows Survivor, where guys are stranded on islands. Try doing that when enemy troops are on the island, too. It's going to be a very interesting rest of Hometown Heroes today. Pete Giannopoulos, the mayor of Taft, at least at one point the mayor of Taft, is our guest today. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Army veterans, I'm sure that got your attention. Caissons Go Rolling Along, that performed there by our friends with the Sounds of Freedom Band. The band's going to be in concert in Visalia on May the 17th at the Gateway Auditorium, just to give you a heads up. I believe they're performing the following week at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. Always good to hear from the Sounds of Freedom Band. And it's going to be a very entertaining show today with Pete Giannopoulos of Taft, California. Was born there. Got through high school there, joined the service, and went back right after the war. But it's that time during World War II that we're going to spend some more time talking about right now. Pete, when we left off, you were still on your way to Australia. You finally got a freshwater shower thanks to Mother Nature pouring some fresh drops down on you. Then you finally get to Australia. And why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay. One other thing I want to mention about that journey on the good ship Mormaxi. We could get fresh water for our canteens during a two-hour period once a day at a designated place. Okay, we sailed into Brisbane, Australia about the middle or latter part of July. They set us up in a racetrack. In fact, it was called the Ascot Racetrack. We lived in tents for 14 days before we headed north. It was not very pleasant because it was winter time in Australia, and all we had were summer clothes from California. We slept on mattress covers filled with straw on the ground inside these tents, and the two blankets that we had been issued over us, and also all the other clothes in our duffel bags put over the blankets.
So I guess it kind of felt like Battle of the Bulge weather to you guys in those clothes.
It was horrible. Anyway, we eventually boarded the train heading north to Rockhampton, where we became replacements in the 41st Infantry Division. And as I mentioned, I was one of those in the 163rd Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they assigned me to a heavy weapons company, but I wasn't there very long. I got called to regimental headquarters, and I had no idea why, but there were several others that were also assigned to regimental headquarters. I should point out that the division called the Sunset Division had just come out of combat in New Guinea,
mm-hmm.
where they had been battling the enemy in places like Lae and Salamoa and Buna.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about depressed when we found out, well, we thought that we would be going home in maybe 18 months or so. These fellows had been over there 18 months already, and there was no indication that they would ever get home before more time was spent.
Plus, I'm sure they had stories to tell about what it had been like in combat.
Did we hear the stories? They had already been, in fact, some of them had been there 30 months and 40 months before they got to go home.
Hmm.
Anyway, we were replacements in the company headquarters of the regiment in the INR platoon, which is called the Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon. And what that means is we were scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And our training was to go on patrols, to find out where the enemy was and report back to headquarters what we had seen.
And how big of a group are you going out in when you do these patrols?
Well, our platoon was probably 20 men in the regimental headquarters company. There were radio men in other parts of the company, message center drivers, truck drivers, and the like. But we were the INR platoon, and since we did have a specialty other than scouting, it seemed we got the dirty work.
Uh-huh.
We got KP and all kinds of duties like that. Well, we trained for these missions that we were to be going on. And, of course, the people that were still in the regiment, in our platoon, had been in combat before, so they knew the ropes pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after about 7 or 8 months in Australia, it was time to move out again. And I should point out at this point that malaria was prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
Mosquitoes, they were all over the place.
Were they as big as the ones in Taft?
Oh, gee. I'm telling you, we would go on scouting missions into the jungle and come out, and our clothes would be black from mosquitoes.
Holy moly.
Anyway, they would give us a pill, a yellow pill called Ativan. Now, the problem was quinine, which cures malaria, had been taken over by the Japanese wherever they were getting quinine.
Mm-hmm.
So they had come up with this pill called Ativan. And the troops that had been to New Guinea were beginning to take it, and they began to give it to us. And what that meant, that twice a day, the whole company would turn out, and we'd pass through a line with our canteen cup filled with water, and they'd put 5 Ativan pills in our palm. And we had to throw those in our mouth, down the pills with the water, take the canteen, our canteen, and turn it over and strike it 3 times on a log that they had there to make sure we didn't spit it out. And the other thing was that we had to remain there for 15 minutes because the pill was so bitter you couldn't hold it in your mouth that long. Well, that happened on Mondays and Fridays. Well, we went north by train to Townsend in Australia, boarded ships, and the whole division, all 22,000 of us, including those other units that are part of the division, field artillery and what have you, and we sailed for New Guinea. First stop was Port Moresby at the southern end of New Guinea, and then around the east end to a place called Finchhaven. And that's where we got off the ships. We set up camp, and we prepared for combat.
Now, at this point, you've been in for a while. Are you kind of getting the itch to see some combat, or could that have waited as long as it wanted to?
I really didn't have any thoughts about it. I was prepared to go in combat. Combat, pretty well trained, what we had to do. As I mentioned earlier, we went on a hike to get us in shape to go into combat, which was a 100-mile hike.
Now, I've heard about the 25-mile hike at Camp Roberts, but 100 miles, that sounds pretty wild.
100 miles. We'd walk all day long, then stop somewhere, camp out for the night, get up the next morning, and take off again until we covered that 100 miles. Well, we didn't stay at Finchhaven very long. We were going to make a landing. The whole division was going to make a landing. And we were split up. Our division was to make a landing at a place called Idaho, further up the coast. And the other two regiments, the 162nd and 186th Regiment, were to make amphibious landings at Hollandia. We loaded up on the ships, and what did our armada? There was something like 180 ships carrying that division and all the other utilities that were going with us. And they went in a direction like they were going to the Philippines, including two carriers that were with us. And then we made a turn to the left and headed toward the coast of New Guinea, splitting up the two regiments that were going to go to Hollandia further north and our division, which was going to Idaho. And that was the first baptism of fire, you might say, that I experienced. On the troop carrier, they would get us up about 2 or 3 in the morning, feed us well, have breakfast. We'd pack our duffel bag, put it aside, which would be brought to us later. We'd have our pack on our back. And then in the dark, we'd go over the side of the ship, down these rope ladders or nets down the side of the ship, to the waiting Higgins boats in the water below.
Mm-hmm. And we've all seen the images of the Higgins boats, largely LCVPs, carrying the infantrymen to the shore to wade ashore in those Pacific islands, not to mention all the vivid images of Normandy. And I've always wondered what that felt like. I've talked to people who have been on them and pilots of Higgins boats, but I've always wondered that infantryman who's in that boat, who's waiting for that door to come open and rush aboard shore. What's going through your mind at a moment like that?
Oh, I really don't remember. I felt pretty good, but what was interesting was that these boats would go out there and circle around and form what was the first wave, the second wave, the third wave as they approached the shore. Now, as it became towards sunlight or dawn, you can't imagine the firepower that we saw. There were destroyers with pointed right toward the shore, and they all began firing at a particular time. And they were dropping those shells right in the beach where we were to land. Not only that, but the fighters came over, and they would strafe the beach. It was the darnest show you ever saw in your life.
And I guess it's pretty entertaining until you realize, uh-oh, my turn's coming up.
You know, I didn't feel bad about that.
No?
But we headed in. I was in the second wave. There were four of us from my platoon that had a special assignment. And our assignment was, as soon as we hit the beach, we were to find a road that would go to the airstrip, which was further inland. And we were to check out a bridge on the way to see if it would hold a tank.
Uh-huh. And you know what? I'm going to cut you off right there, Pete. Unfortunately, we need to get another commercial in here. But hold that thought, and we'll hear if you found that road or if you found something else when we come back to Hometown Heroes. Pete Giannopoulos of Taft is our guest today. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time is flying by today. So let's get right back to Pete Giannopoulos and his story, serving with the 41st Infantry Division, more specifically the 163rd Infantry Regiment, the Jungleers in the South Pacific. And he was telling us about the first landing that he made. He described getting in those Higgins boats, going ashore, and the task, where we left off, was for him and three others to find a road that led to an airstrip to see if it could hold the American tanks on the way there. So, Pete, tell us what you found next.
Well, Paul, we reached the beach, and the Higgins boat, the door goes down, you wade into the water and make your way to the shore, and we noticed people standing on the shore. And we went right through them, right through a village, and out the other side looking for that road. Well, to make a long story short, we found out we had been landed about a mile from where we should have been landed.
Uh-huh.
So we had to go north to try to find that road to the airstrip, which we eventually found. But what happened was we were on the other side of the village, and the enemy was coming out of foxholes and these huts, and the people on the beach were firing at them, and we were on the other side of the village. That was not too good.
So in other words, your troops are firing in your direction.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, we made it to the airstrip. We spent the night there. Eventually, we went north some more to a river in a trail that we found going to the beach, and we decided we would camp out just inland from where 2nd Battalion was camped. Now, I had an unusual experience there. We camped on the ground. We were probably 4 or 5 yards from this trail, and we decided we'd have one or two people awake during the night as guards, although the captain from the battalion came over and said, we're going to have roving guards, so we don't want any firing. Well, it came my turn to be on guard, and I was, like I say, not too far from the trail. In the dark, I saw this figure walking down the trail toward the company to my right. And a few minutes later, he turns around and heads back out toward the jungle. So I woke up the sergeant and told him what I'd seen. And he alerted everybody. But I found that I was about the only one that remained awake.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about the time it became light where you could see, looked up the trail, and here came, there was no mistaking this person. It was a Japanese soldier. I could tell by the unusual hat that they wear.
Mm-hmm.
And he was coming right down the trail toward us. And he got there. I had my gun ready. And the sergeant said, fire! Would you believe I emptied a clip of 8 before that fellow fell almost about a yard away?
He was only a yard away from you?
When he fell, finally.
He was charging at you?
No, he was just walking, and and what was kind of unusual to me was how long it took him to fall forward, unless the bullets were holding him out. Anyway, I reloaded, and here came another one down the trail with his gun ready. And I shot at him, too, and got him. And that was the only time that I can say that I ever knew that I had fired my rifle at enemy soldier and knew that I had killed somebody.
Was that hard for you to deal with at the time? I mean, you're still a pretty young man, and I realize it was either him or you, and you didn't have a whole lot of choice in the matter, but I imagine still emotionally that's tough to wrap your brain around.
It does. As we were taught, you know, kill or be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you had to remember. Anyway, we eventually, about a month later, we pulled into landing. We went out in landing barges again and went further north to land at a place called Tome, T-O-E-M. At Tome, we set up camp, and the artillery was aimed toward an island about a mile or so away from Tome, which is called Wakti Island, on which there was an airstrip and about 800 Japanese soldiers. And after bombardment and strafing for a couple of days, one of our battalions had to make the landing. I fortunately wasn't one of those that had to go, although members of our platoon did.
Now, I imagine, Pete, and you're making these landings, and I'm sure it never gets easy. It never gets old hat. And how often are you looking around and realizing that the guy that you were talking to the day before isn't there to talk to anymore?
That happened at Idaho. We lost one man on a patrol, Edgar Bench. They got ambushed, and he was killed.
And I imagine that you can't help but think, next time that could be me.
That's right. You know, the worst thing about it was at night trying to sleep when you knew the next day they were going to send you on a patrol somewhere. That went in day after day, day after day. And during the night, you'd dream and you'd have these awful, horrible thoughts of what might happen. But when you were ready to go the next day, you were okay. Anyway.
So you made the landing at Tome.
Right. And we had a banzai attack one night there. One of our buddies got hit with a saber across his left shoulder. And the only thing that stopped the saber from going down through his body was that he was in a foxhole. And the saber was stopped by the sandbags on the edge of the foxhole. I could tell you about that, but that may take too much time.
Well, and I'm sure he kept making his foxhole just like that from then on out. I know we don't have that much time, and I want to hear the story, Pete, about Biak, and that is an island that I've heard about before, mostly from pilots who flew over it. I have not talked to someone who was on the ground there, and you were not only on the ground there, you almost got left there. And in fact, you did get left there for a while. Quickly, why don't you get into that story for us? We've probably got about 15 minutes left in this program.
Well, what I was referring to was a hike that we had to make across the island of Biak. Biak is a pretty good-sized island. It's part of the Shuten Island group, and it's just like a coral ridge, you know, a hard rock. And we had to make a hike, a patrol across that island. And we ran into a clearing on the way over about halfway, and they spotted some Japanese there, and they rushed them, and they pretty well got away, so we knew that they knew we were there.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, we proceeded toward the north end of Viak Island, where these three ships were to pick us up. So we had to get there by about 4:30 or 5 in order to board those ships. Well, on the way, we passed through an area where there were foxholes all over the place. And we knew there were Japanese in there, but we proceeded, and we, at several times during the day, a Taylor Cub would come over, and the captain of our unit would communicate with us because radios didn't work too well in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So about the time he was overhead, we got ambushed, and a couple of our fellows got hurt. We did some firing. To our right was a coral ridge, rather steep, and on the left there was another little ridge, but not as high. Our lieutenant told us to go over, two or three of us, to watch that flank, and we did, and eventually he called everybody back. Our own soldiers didn't know we were over there, and they started firing at us.
Oh, man, you've been down that road before. Pete, I need to cut you off one more time. We got to get our last commercial break in here, but we will finish that story and finish the program when we come back. Pete Giannopoulos, my guest. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Not a whole lot of time left, so I won't mess around. Let's pick it back up with Pete Giannopoulos. And before we talk about his experiences in Hiroshima right after the end of World War II, let's talk about that time on the island of Biak that he was describing, where they know the Japanese troops are on one side, the Americans are actually firing in your direction. It is where you left off, Pete. Do I have that right?
Yes. Well, anyway, we all got together again, and we decided we would go up that ridge to the right and go maybe 400 yards and then start down that coral cliff back down toward the beach where we could hear the boats out there with their motors running. Anyway, in order to get quickly up that ridge, the lieutenant and three of us went with him and proceeded as fast as we could. But nightfall prevented us from going too far. You couldn't tell where you were walking on the coral ridge. Sometimes you'd fall in a hole covered with leaves.
So you really couldn't keep moving at night, because if you lit it up, then they know where you are.
We stopped for the night, and then the next morning proceeded down. We finally made it to the beach, and those ships were leaving, and I had a phosphorus grenade that I threw out on the beach, and they heard it and came back. We got back on. The lieutenant then told us to go back in and get the rest of the people, which we did.
So
quickly, we made landings in the Philippines, at Zamboanga, and Jolo Island also.
Well, and I just want to dwell on this for a minute, Pete, and I know that you did receive the Philippine Liberation Medal for your efforts there in the Philippines. You've been awarded the Bronze Star for meritorious conduct in ground combat in the Asiatic Theater. But this situation on Biak, you went by it really quickly there. But you have a phosphorus grenade in your pack that you throw. If you don't throw it, you guys might not get off that island. And if you don't get off that island, what do you think happens to you?
Well, back at regimental headquarters, they thought we were goners.
So they had pretty much written you off, thought you're going to be POWs.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Or dead.
Well, anyway, we got out to the barge or the ships, and then we had to come back in, go to shore, wade in the water, go out up the beach, and try to find the rest of our gang. And we finally did. And we gave them water, and they came back. We all got on the ships, and made it clear around the north end of the island back to our camp.
Well, and I know you're not trying to draw attention to yourself here, but it kind of sounds to me like there are a whole lot of guys who ended up being pretty thankful that you had a phosphorus grenade in your pack.
That's true. I don't know what we would have done. I have no idea.
Wow. Those are the things that get me. Now, I don't want to gloss over the rest of your ground combat, and surviving as much ground combat as you did is pretty remarkable. but you had an opportunity at the end of the war to be part of the occupation forces in Japan, and the area that you were assigned to was Hiroshima. So you saw firsthand the devastation of the first atomic bomb that had ever been used as a weapon in the history of the world. What kinds of things did you see there, and what was it like to be there at such a historic time?
All I saw was total destruction. And what impressed me was that all of that was as a result of one bomb that had fallen over that city. And we drove around. It was very difficult to drive because there was still debris in the streets and all that. We went to the Hiroshima City Hall, I might add, which was pretty well burned out. But it was a three-story building. We climbed to the top where we'd get a beautiful view of all the destruction. We went into one room, large room, and it was just piled high of little boxes. And these boxes were bones and ashes of people that had been killed.
Holy cow.
It was incredible.
I can't imagine witnessing those kinds of things. And I guess in the big picture, you would have been invading Japan had the bomb not been dropped. So perhaps that bomb saved your life, but you got to see up close and personal the lives that it cost to drop that bomb.
Well, their estimates are that if we had gone in and we had been practicing amphibious landing to make the initial landing in the southern part of Japan, along with the 32nd Division, there could have been a million casualties, a million dead, not only of our troops, but also the Japanese Army, the civilians, young and old, who had been taught how to fire rifle and defend the homeland. So I was very happy with President Truman making the decision to drop that bomb.
I'm still blown away by the fact that he didn't even know about that bomb until President Roosevelt died and he became president, and within months he's making the decision to deploy it. But that's a story for another time. I want to hear from you. I believe you brought back a very meaningful and special memento of your time in Hiroshima. Why don't you share with our listeners what that is?
Well, I did. In driving around the area, I saw the ruins of a Catholic church off a street. I stopped and I walked over the ruins and debris and walked inside that church. There's nothing but the walls left. And as I was looking around, I looked down and I found this crucifix. It's about maybe 4 inches long, scarred from fire. And I picked it up. The picture of Christ is still on the cross. And I brought it home. And it's been mounted in an appropriate way on my wall and has been there ever since. There were times that I was wondering whether it was radioactive, because after we'd been there a while, they made Hiroshima off limits. They didn't know anything about radiation, and I often wondered whether did I get a case of radiation myself. But anyway, I'm 84 years old, and no sign of any illness from radiation that I know of.
Wow. So you have a crucifix hanging in your home that still bears the scars of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And I won't get into the symbolism there, but I think it's pretty clear to all of us. And Pete, unfortunately, we're running out of time on the program here. I know that you've had a very active and busy life and have served the city of Taft so well in all the years since you came home from the war. You ever stop and think about all the times you came close to not coming back from the war and why you were one of the ones who got to come home?
Well, that has occurred to me. Somebody had to be watching over me. I was on patrols when we ran into booby traps. Guys were blown away. We were bombed in our company, the center of our company with a bomb from an airplane. We were strafed one time as we were going on a patrol. I shot at. Mortar, I remember one time in a ridge, we were carrying waters to troops, and the enemy found us, and they zeroed in with their mortars. And I remember you couldn't dig anywhere. You couldn't get down in the coral, just crouched down. And I actually saw a mortar shell go off within about 5 yards from me, but the angle which it hit, it didn't splatter any shrapnel my way.
Well, I have to agree, Pete. Someone was definitely looking out for you. Unfortunately, we're out of time on the program today, but thank you so much for serving our country and for sharing some of those stories with me and with our listeners today. That's Pete Giannopoulos, the mayor of Taft, and you can read his articles in the Midway Driller down there. That's Hometown Heroes today, News Talk 580 KMJ.